Good morning. So last time we talked about mostly assembly, but we started off by talking about a few extra topics related to linking. I mentioned briefly that there were different kinds of relocations, that's holes for the linker to fill in, because sometimes the machine code needed an address, sometimes it needed something that was based on an address but wasn't in the same format, like an offset to an address, which were both things we needed the linker to compute because we need to know where are things actually in memory. But the linker needs to do a slightly different job. You also briefly mentioned that dynamic linking happens, that the linking I described in my picture of what's in every file is the version where we do everything when we produce the executable. The default on most recent systems is that some of the linking happens when we produce the executable, and some happens later on, so we can load a library at runtime and share it between multiple programs and update it without updating every single program. We then talked about assembly, including probably the most important thing to get used to, which is that we're using AT&T syntax. So in this class, we have a different assembly syntax because that's what our book uses, that's what some tools we'll use later in the semester use. And the big differences were that in AT&T syntax, the destination is always last. And this included the case where this was most confusing, which is subtract and compare. And we have this funny syntax for specifying accessing memory using some registers and some constants, where we have an offset, a base register, an index, and a scale, and that does this computation, where the base and the index are registers, the scale and the offset are constants. Does this computation to compute an address, and then accesses memory at that address. And we also briefly mentioned that you'll see jump with a star. That means we use the thing after the star as the address, as the place to get the address where the next instruction is. We talked about LEA for load effective address, which is kind of like move. We do everything we would do for move. We compute a memory address, but we don't access the memory address. We just take that memory address and put it in the results. And we looked at some exercises with writing assembly, so how we convert something like an if then else, or a do while to assembly. And since we were talking about these things where we had conditionals, we talked about how conditionals in x86 really worked. And the trick there was we had these condition codes. So we had some special registers which store the result of the last arithmetic, and that was what instructions like jump equal look at. They don't actually get paired with a compare instruction. They're separate instructions that you can run separately. There's this extra register in the processor that the instructions like compare set that jump equal reads. And we learned that not just jump equal, this is not just compare instruction set then. There's a whole bunch of instructions, basically anything that does arithmetic sets. Then we'll talk more about exactly what that is later today. So any questions about anything we talked about last time? Yes?
Is it possible to store condition codes on the stack so that when you call, like, you return from the subroutine, you get them back?
So the question is, can we save condition codes in some way so we can restore them later? Yes. So you already, in fact, know enough to do this. So you could just write a whole bunch of conditional jumps and write out the information in the condition codes to the stack, and then you can do a whole bunch of comparisons based on what you wrote out to store them back. There is, in fact, a better mechanism x86 provides for this, because some things like the operating system frequently want to do this. The operating system runs while another program is running. It needs to save the condition codes because it doesn't want the other program to notice. So there is a mechanism for doing this, and there are special instructions we just haven't talked about for writing the condition codes out to the stack or a register. Yes? So the question is, what's the order of operations here? The way I have it written out here, if you just do your old algebra, it's right. So I times S is not, it's not the quantity B plus I, it's just I times S. Other questions? Okay. So first, a brief logistical reminder. So I mentioned we have quizzes in this class, and they start after this class. So around 7 p.m. tonight, there will be a quiz released, which is for this week's lecture, which you need to complete by Monday sometime in the afternoon. You can look at the quizzes page linked off the top of the website for all the exact times if you want to find that out. So let's show you what our quizzes look like. And we're going to do that and hi. Oh, well, that would explain my problem. Okay, so this is what the quiz interface looks like. You will get something like this. And for some of the quizzes, it will say available. It will say this time they're open, the time they close, and it will say a time limit. So the way the time limit works is when you start the quiz, your clock starts ticking down and you have that amount of time. So in this case, and for all of our quizzes, it's probably going to be 90 minutes. And what you'll do, and when you ask me to take a quiz, you'll go to interface. It will ask you, do you really want to do it? If you click OK, it will start your timer. That's why we ask. I guess some people get annoyed if they misclick and don't intend to do it. And you'll get a page like this. So you'll have some quiz questions. These are not the ones we're asking you. These are just demonstration, since you don't know some of these. And you'll choose an answer. And when it turns green, your answer is recorded. If it turns yellow and stays yellow, your answer is not being recorded. Yellow means it's trying to send your answer. Green means it has. So your answer is recorded. And this means, for example, if you go away from this page and say reload this, it says it's in progress. And because it turned green, if I go back, my answer is still there. You can write comments. So if you think the quiz question is ambiguous or you otherwise need to clarify your answer, write a comment. We will eventually look at the comments and adjust the quiz grades accordingly. We might increase your grade or decrease it, depending on what your comment says. And some of the questions are select all that apply like this. So you can select multiple. And that's generally the way that's going to be scored is generally that we're going to divide the points evenly among each of the checkboxes. Yes?
What would be an example of a comment that would decrease?
If your comment shows that you may have accidentally guessed the correct answer, but you clearly do not know what the question is asking about, is generally what we'll look for. Yes?
And in the select all questions, what if you get one right and one wrong? Does it just give you?
So the question is I got one right and one wrong in the select all question. So each checkbox is treated like a separate question.
Okay.
So this whole thing is going to be worth 1 point. The first part is worth a third of a point. Second part is worth a third of a point. So you can write comments here. So an important note about comments is that we randomize the order of the answer letters. So please do not refer to answer letters in your comments, just refer to what the answer is actually saying. Otherwise, the person grading it will look at your comment and they won't have a good way of figuring out what was A for you. So if you need to refer to an answer letter, for question one, if you wanted to say, don't say B, say, just copy and paste it or something like that. Something so we know which answer you're referring to, even though we randomized them. Okay, so that's the quizzes. When quizzes are closed, you can go to the quiz page and you can see how you did and the correct answers. If you wrote comments, when the comments will be looked at after sometime later, we don't have instantly, the minute the quiz is closed, look at all your comments. So you might have to wait about a week for those to apply. If that happens, there will be a response from the grader in this page, along with any adjustment. But we give these immediately because we figure you'd like to know what we thought.
Yeah. So how do you grade the multiple choice?
So how do we grade the multiple choice?
Yeah.
So the machine grading is just, is it correct or not? 1 point per question for select all, divide each checkbox is a purport, redivide 1 point into however many checkboxes there are, that many points per checkbox.
So what if I select one correct one and select the one?
For a select all, each one is a separate question.
Okay.
For a select one, you can't do that. Okay. Any questions about the quizzes? Yes. Okay. I do need to explain that. So the percentages here are the percent of students who answered that way. The score is up here, which will be more clear when you see it. So that will give you an idea, was this actually a hard question that fooled a lot of people or not? Yes. Yes. So this person got one part, this question was right. The other two were not. So that's why they got 1/3. And this is that. So they got 0 points on A because they should have checked it because it's marked as a correct answer. They got 1/3 of a point on B because they didn't check it and it wasn't a correct answer. And they got 0 points on C because they did check it and it was not a correct answer. So that works out to 1/3. So the only thing they got points on was this case B, where they agree with the correct answer. They've agreed with the correct response, which was that it's not right, not true. So the things marked correct answer are what you should have checked or put a radio button next to. And occasionally we might miss key quizzes. If so, let us know and we can fix that, like, and regrade it. We'll try to avoid doing that, but because when you write a quiz every week, mistakes get made sometimes, or you miss corner cases. We'll try really hard not to do that, but it might happen. Okay, so any other questions on the quizzes? Okay, so there's a post-quiz after this lecture. This is all on the schedule, which I guess I should actually show. Go here to schedule, which looks funny. On assignment, we said quiz. Here, and we also say quiz one due at 10:45. The pre-quizzes I have to at 10:45 because I don't want you doing them during this lecture. And there is substantial overlap between when the pre and post-quiz are released, so if you want to just sit down at one point in time and do both of them, that is perfectly fine. For the pre-quizzes, we will generally try to be on the reading, so you might want to do the reading or at least have the textbook in front of you. Okay, so
is lab two still tentative?
Lab two is still marked as tentative. That will not be true by the weekend. Okay, so last time we were talking about condition codes, which as I mentioned, was our information about the last arithmetic result that things like junk use. And because this applies to all arithmetic operations, we have names like junk greater than, junk less than, and so on, but they're all named based on assuming the arithmetic operation is subtraction. So zero is equal, less than zero is less than, greater than zero is greater than. But this applies no matter what operation we actually do. So if we do an addition, we still interpret the result in the same way. do a multiplication, we still interpret the result in the same way, even though the naming might not make sense. And so that means, for example, we give this example here, if we do a subtraction, we get 30 in this case. 30 is greater than 0, therefore jump less than equal won't do it because it's checking, is the result less than or equal to 0? And this acts like a comparison would. So this is, has the same effect, except it doesn't change RBX at the end. That's what our compare instruction is, just a subtract that doesn't change things. And test is a bitwise AND, which we'll learn what that is, that doesn't actually write out the result, but computes it, sets these condition codes, was it less than 0, greater than 0, and so on. So when you're doing, for example, the bomb lab, something you'll often see is that the compiler often takes advantage of this. So that do while loop I showed you before, in my simple translation, I did a compare with 0. But we're just before in that doing a subtraction, which is going to compute the same result. It's going to compute R12 minus 1 and set that into R12. Now we're taking the new R12, subtracting 0 from it, which just computes the same value. So we can actually omit the comparison and rely on the condition codes being set by this subtract rather than being set by this compare, because they'll be set in the same way. And compilers are very good at doing this, very good at recognizing that they can do that. And this gives you an idea of why someone decided we should have condition codes be set by things that aren't a compare operation. Because this is convenient for assembly language programming, because for writing loops, because you need to adjust the loop counter anyways. So often you can do that in a way where you don't need an extra comparison instruction. So any questions about what happened here? Okay. And as I mentioned, these instructions work the same way. They do the same checking of the result regardless. So in this case, we move 20 into RBX. We subtract 20 from it by adding negative 20. And that produces 0. And since it's 0, jump equal is going to say, let's go. This doesn't matter that we, that if you compare negative 20 and RBX, they don't compare that way, they aren't equal. That's not what jump equal is checking. It's checking, was the result 0? So any questions about this? So I told you that basically all arithmetic and these special comparison instructions have the condition code, and that's basically true. So we have some instructions that only set them, most of the arithmetic instructions do. So it's easier to talk about what instructions don't set condition codes. And the big ones are LEA and move. So move instructions aren't computing anything, so that makes sense. LEA, this makes a little less sense because you think of LEA as it's doing arithmetic, that's why you're using it, but in fact does not set the condition codes. This is just a special case. I don't expect you to have guessed that. Someone asked earlier, before when I talked about LEA, how is it different than doing an LEA to add 4, different than using add to add 4? This is the big way in which it's different. And also all our control flow instructions don't change the condition codes. So if you do a conditional jump, the condition codes are still there, you can do another conditional jump, it will use the same comparison. The same thing with this move. If you do a move, the condition codes remain the same as they were set before. It still remembers that. There's this extra register in the processor to do that, even if you get rid of the values that were being involved in the arithmetic that set the condition codes. So any questions about these? So this means, in particular, that if we do something like this, we set RBX to 0 by adding, again, negative 20 to 20. The result is 0, so the condition codes are equal. And if we move 1 into RIX, the jump equal is still going to go because that move doesn't change the condition codes. Just going to leave them unchanged, even though, you know, you might think of it as producing a result, not for the purposes of condition codes. Yes, I would know. The way you would find this out, when you would know what instructions do that, if you actually need to look, know, you need to look it up, because at some point it's kind of an arbitrary decision. But usually when you're writing assembly, this won't be an issue, because usually you'll make sure you put the thing you want to set the condition codes right before you use them. So now that we know how condition codes work, let's look at turning some more loops into actual working assembly. Let's start with this while loops. What's a good first step for me if I want to convert this to assembly? Yeah?
Change it into go-tos.
Okay, change it into go-tos. So what would that look like, roughly?
It would be like, it would be a comparison, or yes, subtraction instruction or comparison instruction, and then either a jump, conditional jump, and if not, you go to the comparison part again.
Okay, so that was a little muffled. Used. So there's two things we need to worry about. So we need to worry about doing this comparison, and we also need to worry about what happens here, what happens at the end of the loop. So the most straightforward thing is that we convert this while part into a do we want to do another iteration of the loop? And if not, go to after loop. And we convert the bottom part, the end of the loop, to let's go to the beginning, let's go to that check, do you want to do another iteration of the loop? So that's the most straightforward way to translate this. And again, I cannot write comparisons. Okay. So we do the correct direction of comparison, which I apparently corrected on another slide, but not this one. Okay. So we do the correct direction of comparison, go to the end of the loop, otherwise we go to the start. Note that this is different than our do while loop before, and the most common thing people forget when they're either converting loops like this into assembly or checking if a loop, trying to convert assembly back into C, is that the comparison's at the top, and that often makes a difference. Because it will give a different answer, because we'll call foo a different number of times. Yes?
Is the symbol for the x greater than or equal to 0, what is it supposed to be?
It's supposed to be less than. So we want less than because we're skipping the loop in that case, where the condition in the while is, of course, do you want to do the loop? So I inverted the comparison. Like I could have also, and maybe it's would be even clearer to write this. So then we have our assembly. See, I had it right on that slide. We have our pseudo C, our C with go-tos. And we can just translate that line by line into assembly. We can get that compare and conditional jump talked about before. And I might be neglecting issues with whether razors are calling or caller saved. But this is our basic structure. Just line by line, translate it into assembly, and then we have the while loop. So this is probably the most straightforward way of translating a loop into assembly. But you might discover, for example, in the BOM lab, that this is not always what the compiler does. Yes?
Is that jump comment to also have additional?
Yes, that jump the comment is wrong. The comment is wrong, the code is right. Yeah.
So in the BOM lab, is this are the phases like actually compiled assembly, or did people manually write them in assembly?
The question is, in the BOM lab, are the phases actually compiled assembly? Yes, there is a C program that was compiled to produce your BOM. So everything you're seeing is stuff compilers actually generate. Yes?
Is there, wait, why is X assigned to R12? Is that just?
That's an arbitrary choice. Yeah, this is a completely arbitrary choice. Why I assigned X to R12, I need to put it somewhere, and I didn't want to put it in memory. So I put it in the register. Yes?
I think you might be getting this, but does compile assembly treat this using loops and the original while loop we had like completely differently?
What do you mean, does compile assembly treat this using loops in the original while loop differently?
So this is the compiled assembly for what we have up top.
Yes.
If we use the original while loop, will the compiled assembly look like drastically different than what we see here?
So the question is this really what the compiler would generate? And the answer is sometimes. So compilers do lots of things, because there are actually lots of options to translate this into assembly. So that gives me to this question. So I have three different things, and zero or more of them are correct. But they're all close to correct. They're all things where you could make some minor change and you get the right thing. So tell me, decide amongst yourselves, which of these are actually correct versions? This. Because what we showed was just one way of translating to assembly. Compilers, for reasons we'll discuss in a second, often want to do other things. Yes, you're allowed to talk amongst yourselves. This is not a solved silent. Yes.
What condition says
J greater than equal 0?
Is greater
Okay, does any volunteers to tell me about one of these they think is not a correct translation?
A is not correct.
So why is A not correct?
Because you're calling before checking the condition.
Yeah. So A is not correct because maybe B is greater 10 or greater, in which case we call foo at least one more time than we're supposed to. So we can tell from that that B is not correct. We don't even need to reason about whether this is right or not. Wait, I think it is otherwise, but because we call foo, even if B is 10 or greater, it's wrong. Any other versions people think are wrong would like to explain back there? Okay.
So it has a condition like it should be less than 10.
Mm-hmm.
Does 10 minus the input?
Yeah, so this is computing 10. So this computes, this subtracts B from 10. So this computes 10 minus B and asks whether that's greater than or equal to 0. Which is the wrong direction of comparison for greater than equal. It would be correct if we changed it to, I believe, less than. And I believe version B is correct. We compare B to 10. If it's greater than or equal to 10, we go to the end. Otherwise, we call foo, add 1 to B, go back, check again. So one thing you might notice about this is that it's a pity that version A isn't the right one because it's a little shorter. And in fact, compilers will take advantage of that. So we had, you know, our straightforward translation, but compilers might not do quite that. So for example, these are all things I managed to get my compiler to generate for this, except I fixed up which register was used for B. It wasn't always RBX. So we can actually get this version, where we see the straightforward while loop translation. With some options to my compiler, I get that. We can get this version. So why would the compiler want to generate this version? Yeah. Yeah. So we've made the loop shorter by doing this, because we have our comparison with 10 is out of the loop, but we don't have that extra jump. We don't have this jump start loop anymore. We just have a conditional jump at the end. And compilers like making the loops as short as possible, so especially when you ask for optimizations. So this is one of the things they'll do. And I also got my compiler to generate this version. So why did the compiler want to do that? And this is much less obvious that this is equivalent, by the way. It could take a while to figure out what it's doing. Anyone want to describe, first of all, what is happening in this version of the loop? What did the compiler do? Back there?
I have a question
on the
second. OK.
Okay, it's not the same code, perhaps, yeah. Okay, back there? Yeah.
So for the third one, before the loop starts, it's subtracting B from 10, or whatever's in our case, from 10.
Okay.
Inside the loop, it decrements B, so it's like continuously subtracting until it gets 0. So when B does finally get 0, it moves on to 10, instead of jumping back.
Okay, so it's subtracting 10 from B, which is the big observation. So basically what's happening here is the compiler is doing this trick. It's making a B prime equals 10 minus B. And it's updating B prime. So B prime minus equals 1 is the same thing as B plus equals 1. So it's maintaining this B prime that's actually always 10 minus B. And that means that when B prime becomes 0, that's the same as B equals 10. And that means we're done with the loop, with the J and E. So it lets it do its decrement and use the result directly without a comparison to check the condition codes. So by doing that, it saved one instruction in the loop. One whole instruction. But this is the sort of thing compilers, optimizing compilers actually try to do. When you ask them to do enough optimizations, they would, you know, do all this extra work, all this setup at the beginning of the loop to transform B into 10 minus B and make sure that it's in bounds, so it's safe to do this, safe to do the equals zero, B prime equals zero comparison, just to save one instruction in the loop. Yeah?
Would it decide whether to do this or not based on how many times you're going through the loop?
Question is, would it decide whether to do this or not based on how many times you're going through the loop? So that's an interesting question. If I'm just giving it a function which looks like this and takes B as an argument, it does has no reason, no way to know how many times it goes through the loop. So it's going to make a guess. And usually the guess is you're going to go through the loop enough time that it's probably worth it, at least when you ask for a lot of optimizations. There are ways you can tell compilers like how many times you go through loops, but they're not actually very commonly used. Yeah?
Is this one actually more efficient than B?
So the question is C actually faster than B? This is a complicated question, and if I actually wanted to answer it, I would write a program and check. We'll learn throughout the semester lots of reasons why the answer might be yes or the answer might be no. Okay, so any questions about anything on here?
Are these kinds of optimizations usually hard-coded in, or are they like, you're doing some sort of like algebra, whatever?
Question is, are these kinds of optimizations hard-coded in, or is there something general the compilers are doing which results in this? My understanding is that mostly there's some hard-coded heuristics to look for patterns.
Okay.
That's not always the case. And I think that's usually what most of these loop optimizations come from. So someone noticed this is a common pattern and wrote this code to do this transformation. Okay. So we saw about loops and all our options our compiler has. So let's talk a little more concretely about the condition code. So I told you that we store the result of the last arithmetic result, whether it's equal to zero, less than, greater than. The way on x86 that this is stored is that we have two flags. So these are one-bit special registers that you can't like name in an instruction, but they're one-bit special registers. There's one called ZF for zero flag, which stores was the result zero. And if we do a subtraction or compare, that means it was equal, right? If we subtract two values and get zero, they were equal. We have another one called the sign flag, which stores was the result negative, which we, when we do a subtraction means we had less than. SF for sign flag, it's called the sign flag because we just take the sign bit of the result and put it in the sign flag. So you see here that we're basically storing two bits from every arithmetic result, not the whole 64-bit value. And these are the bits that something like the jump greater than equal is checking. So there are some extra bits, the extra condition code bits that we won't talk about very much. I'll probably show you them briefly to handle things like overflow, because I haven't, like what if the subtraction is out of range, we still want the comparison to do the right thing, so that in fact does happen. So if you do a compare instruction, it in fact remembers that, oh, we actually couldn't store the exact results, so that jump less than will do the right thing. And this is also the array in which there's a, so if you read in the assembly, who saw some instruction like JA, JAE, or JB, JBE? Anyone? Some people? So these are unsigned conditional instructions, and the way they differ is how they deal with cases where the signed result overflows. So there's extra condition codes to do that. We're not going to talk about how they work very much. We're just mostly because we're not going to have you implement them. So when you read about Y86 next week, you'll find out that there's one of these called the overflow flag. We're not going to have you implement that when we have you make a processor. We're just going to say that if you do a comparison that overflows, you get the wrong answer. But on real X86, that is not an acceptable result. You would like it when you compare int max with something that you get the correct result of the comparison. That, you know, it's int max is greater than int min, not something else. So in GDB, you can see this as part of the eflags register if you type infowrench, which has some other flags that we don't talk about. And you'll see it written out with like something written like eflags, I believe some actual value, and I think they writes out like SF if SF is set. So any questions about these two flag registers? And so what our compare instructions and our arithmetic instructions are actually doing is setting these registers. So compare RAX RBX computes RBX minus RAX, which in this case is going to be did I actually do the right answer? 20 minus minus 10. It's going to be 30, which doesn't change the flag bits, but is a bit different. So it's going to be 30, but that means SF is 0. The sign bit of 30 is 0. And ZF is 0 because the result is not 0. And similarly here, our add produces a result of 0. As part of producing that result, we're going to check, we're going to copy its sign bit to the sign flag. And that's going to be 0 in this case. And we're going to check whether the result is 0. So there's some hardware which checks all the bits to see if they're all zeros. And if so, sets the 0 and sets the 0 flag based on that. In this case, it sets it to 1. And the move instruction doesn't change SF or ZF. It only writes to RAX. It doesn't write to anything else. So any questions on what happens here? Okay. And so I'll just mention this briefly. So the two other important condition codes that you might see in GDB, there's the CF for the carry flag and OF for the overflow flag, and these are both just, did the computation, like the subtraction overflow, did it produce the wrong result? CF is, did it produce the wrong result if we treat it as an unsigned operation? And OF is, did it produce the wrong result if we treat it as a signed operation? So we're not going to have you figure out how these are set, but I'd like you to know they exist. And in fact, the conditional jump instructions use them to make sure that when you compare int min and int max, you still get the right answer as far as whether jump less than jumps. And these are also set by like a normal subtract operation or normal add operation. So any questions about condition codes? Because our next topic is C. Okay. So I mentioned in our first class that C is basically C++ with some features missing. So some of this will be familiar to you. So the most notable features we're missing are that these are our data types, and we'll also have something called structs, which are kind of like classes, but not quite. But we won't have classes. And I'm missing a couple types you might be used to here. We do have signed and unsigned types, versions of all these types. And these are the sizes we're going to have for this course, which is the same as you had when you took 2150 on the lab machines. Like in 2150, we mentioned briefly, we'll emphasize it here. On different machines, you might see different sizes for some of these types. So one thing that's missing from that list, and it's not because I forgot to put it, is bool. So in C, C++, you had a bool type. In C, we are not going to have one. So you may ask, what's the result of comparing two values then? What happens when I do x equals equals 4? What do I get if I don't get a bool? Well, you get an int. Yes, I know that probably doesn't make sense, but that's what the C standard document that people wrote says. You get an int. It's 1 if it's true, 0 otherwise. And this is true for all the comparison operations, all the logical operations that exist in C. They all return ints, and it's 1 if it's true, 0 if it's false. So false values, 0 is a false value. Pointers cast to 0, null pointers, are false values. All other values are true, which is why the comparisons doing what they do works. So any questions on true and false values in bool? Yeah.
Why don't they use shorts to store the...
The question is, why don't they use shorts or some other smaller type? So the idea behind ints in C is that they're usually set to the natural size of a register. And the thought is that you want to do everything in the size of the machine register, or else you might have things go slower because you need to actually truncate values. So that was why I think the decision was made. I'm not on the standards committee, so I don't know for sure. But I believe it's mainly just because their thought is ints are the natural size. You might have to do extra work on some machines to work with smaller types. Yeah. So the question is, what's the point of using shorts? They take up less space. It's the big thing. But the thought is, they save space, and for some things that's going to be faster. And for the most part, when the compiler is doing computation in shorts, it can pretend they're like ints. Right? Because usually it doesn't change things. There's just a few special cases where it needs to actually worry about it being a short. Yes?
Can you explain one more time what you meant?
The line. Okay, so 0 is a false value. It is the only false value. All false values in C are some form of 0. As a special case, this includes null pointers, which is what you get if you cast 0 to a pointer. So those are all false values. Everything else is true. So a pointer that's not null is true. An integer that is like -1 is true. And so on. And like the ASCII code for 0 is true. Okay. So that's true and false values. So and this happens with all the logical operations. I'd like to talk about one of them, which is, first our logical OR operation, our double pipe. So you've seen this in C++ and Java. And I'd like to talk about something which is true in C++ and Java that you probably just didn't know about how OR works, how logical OR. So here, I have a program where I'm outputting with, we'll talk about printf later, but %d means output an integer. So, and outputting an integer where I put the %d, and the thing I'm outputting in the integer is this value, 0. Or 0 pipe pipe 1, where 0 is a function that returns 0 after printing out 0, and 1 is a function that returns 1 after printing out 1. And the output of this program is I print out 0, I print out 1, and then I get the result of 0 ORed with 1, and I get 1. Makes sense. And then I do 1 ORed with 0. So I print out 1. And then I get a result of 1. You might say, are you missing a line? No. This is in fact the output you will get. And so the way logical OR works in C and C++ and Java is that it evaluates from left to right and does as little work as it needs as it can. So when we start with 0, it says, okay, 0 is false, so the possible results are false or true, so I need to keep going. And that's why it needs to check on the 1, because it doesn't know yet whether the result is 0 or 1. When we start with 1, it says, okay, so that's true, and the possible results for this logical OR are true or true. Well, there's only one possibility, so I don't need to check anything else, so I'm going to stop. And this is known as short-circuiting. So it finds out that 1, it knows the result's going to be 1, so it just returns 1 right away from the logical OR operation and doesn't bother calling our 0 function. So you might say this is an optimization. Well, it kind of looks like one, but it's not. Compilers are required to do this always. Like, you can rely on this happening. Compilers have to do this. This also means that compilers have to implement logical OR with jump instructions. Because the code they're going to generate for this, it's going to be like our if statement. Even though you think of it as computing a value, we actually have to jump over the call to one of these functions in some cases. Yeah?
Can we use some form of parentheses to make it call both functions?
The question is, if I add some parentheses, will it call both functions? No. If you want it to call both functions, you can do something like put one of them in a temporary variable and use that. So I showed you this with logical OR. The same principle applies to the logical AND. So in logical AND here, we call our 0 function, it prints out 0. And we get a false value, and we look at our truth table for AND. We know that one part is false, and the only possible results are false. So we're done. We don't need to check about the other side of the AND. We already know we can return 0, and the compiler will generate code that stops there. So we don't ever call 1 for this first line. In the second line, we call 1, we look at our truth table, we find out, well, it could be true or false, so we need to keep going. So we call 1, then we call the next part. So any questions about short-circuiting AND and OR? Okay. So next topic is something which should be kind of familiar, which is about how strings work in C. So in C, we do not have a string type. There is no string type. Instead, the way we will represent strings is with a pointer to character, and that will point to the first character of the string, and we will know where the end of the string is by having this special character at the end, which I write as \0, it's the thing with ASCII code 0. So it's a byte with value 0. And that's how we know where the end of the string is. C strings of this style, if you want to put a byte with value 0 in the middle of them, sorry, you can't do it. You need to use some other stored data structure. So any questions on what strings look like? Yes?
Are they enforced to be ASCII?
So the question is, are they enforced to be ASCII? So conceptually, you might run across a system with a C compiler that doesn't use ASCII, but in our systems, they will always use ASCII. Or some superset of ASCII. Yes? So what does const do? Const says, I promise that this is not modified. In this case, this is a pointer to a const char. So I'm promising the thing being pointed to will not be modified. And the reason I'm doing that is because this string here is going to be in read-only data because it's a constant. So when I do this, the compiler is not going to give me a copy of the string. It's going to point me to the original version in the executable, and I better not modify that because it might be used, like, if I call this function again. Yes?
Can you reassign the pointer?
Can I reassign the pointer? Yes. If you can declare a pointer that you promise you won't change, but the syntax for that looks so different. So this is a pointer I can't change because I have a const after the star. We will never do this. You don't need to worry about it, but that's what it looks like. Yes?
I just want to clarify. You said you can't have a C string that has a zero somewhere in the middle, right?
Yes, because we say that the not the ASCII letter zero, but like a zero byte, yes. Because we say a zero byte is how we know where the string ends. Yes?
How does the compiler know where the constant connects to the string or not?
How does it know what? How does it know if it's a constant string? So we're declaring that we promise not to modify the thing through the pointer. The compiler actually will let you assign it to a non-const pointer. It's just that because we put it in read-only data, you might get a seg fault if you try to change it. But the compiler actually doesn't check, doesn't really know very much. We know this is a constant string in this case because it's a string constant that we're just getting a pointer to. Yes? Yeah. So the question is, you can cut off a chunk of a char star by inserting zero. So if you insert a zero byte, then anything that which treats that as a C string will stop there. Like, you'll still have the other bytes in memory, and if you know that there's something there, you can still access them. Yes?
Is determining the length of a string a linear time operation?
So is determining the length of a C string a linear time operation? Yes, we need to just go through each character until we find the end. Okay. So I'd like to talk a little bit about pointer arithmetic. So pointers, you know, from 2150 are things that contain addresses. And one thing you probably didn't do in 2150 is that you can do arithmetic with pointers. So I can take my pointer hello to this string and add zero to it. That gives me the same pointer. I can add five to it, and that changes the address in the pointer by five, and therefore gives me a pointer to the space in the string. And if I pass that to something which specs as a C string, it's going to say that's the string space world. And I can dereference this and get the character that it points to. And this is, in fact, exactly the same as doing array indexing. So you learned in 2150 that you can have a pointer that points to an array, and you can do array indexing on it. So the way array indexing for pointers works in C and C++ is that it's exactly equivalent. I mean, really exactly. Like, more exactly than you would think, because you can, like, write five bracket hello. Not that you should, ever. But it's exactly equivalent to that. And this is true even for arrays for just native arrays. So the rule is that something like that star foo plus bar and foo bar are exactly the same. This is even true if you have something like char foo 100. And the way that works is when you use an array in a place where it looks like you're trying to use a pointer, C will convert it to a pointer for you. They aren't actually the same type. We'll talk about that later, about how they're not actually the same kind of type. But it will convert it for you. I'm going to call this decaying into pointers. So this array foo, if I do char star p equals foo, because I'm asking for a pointer, it's going to implicitly convert that to a pointer to the first element of the array. And this also applies if I do something else which needs a pointer, like adding one. Because there's no adding to an array doesn't make sense, but adding to a pointer does, so it's going to convert it to a pointer to do that. Yes?
We don't add numbers, we don't index
it. So when I add numbers, is that in decimal or hex? It's an integer like any integer you put in an int. So if you want hexadecimal, you can write OX. If you don't, it's decimal. It doesn't matter that you're adding to a pointer doesn't affect how it interprets an integer constant. Yes? So the question is, what happens when I access out of range of an array using this? And the answer, also in C++ for arrays, is that conceptually, the compiler probably will try to access whatever memory is there. And that may or may not do something interesting. The compiler is allowed to catch that you're doing that and you're not supposed to, but often won't. Okay, so I showed you this equivalency, and I'm surprised we didn't get any complaints, but wait a moment. You just said this is exactly the same, but you've only been showing examples with chars. I've done like this with ints. You have to add more than one to an int to get the next thing in an array. How does that work? And the rule is that when you add things to pointers, the compiler looks at the size of the thing being pointed to and scales what you add by that. So in this case, when I'm adding 2 to this pointer, because it points to an int, and ints are 4 bytes on my system, the compiler is going to generate assembly code which adds 8. So the assembly generated for this is going to be something like add q 8, and like wherever I'm putting the pointer. That is. So the compiler would do that scaling for you based on whatever the size of the pointer types. This is one of the important reasons you need to have your pointer point to the correct type of value. So in this case, I have a pointer to an array, and it initially points to 10, and I can set that 10 to 20 using it. Then I increment it by 2. And it points to 12, and I set that to 30. So incrementing and decrementing from pointers is always adjust them by slots in an array, basically. That's the way you can think about it. And the way this works out in math on the addresses is that we subtract the value, or add the value you're adding to the pointer, times the size of the thing being pointed to. Because our arrays are always contiguous in memory. There was one value immediately followed by the next. Yes?
So if you want to make it more general, could you just say size of the variable or type?
Yeah, so in general, so the question is, can we just write what this does generally with size of? Yeah, so in general, if you do pointer plus equals x, this internally adds x times size of whatever the pointer points to the address. Yes? Is there a way to tell it to not do that? No. However, you can do something like cast a pointer to an integer and cast back from the integer to a pointer, or more commonly, cast a pointer to unsigned char and manipulate the unsigned char pointer, which goes by units of one byte because that's the size of an unsigned character, then cast back. And if you see real code that needs to do that, that's usually what they'll do. So any other questions on this example? Okay, and some notes on precedence, since we're talking about pointers. These are things that might have come up in 2150, but probably not, that are confusing that you might see in real C code or be tempted to write. So one note is that if I take the address of an array element, or the syntax, which can also apply to pointers, that's the same as access finding the thing based on foo and taking the address of it. It's not the other order. Similarly, if I dereference foo of 0, that's the same as accessing foo of 0 and dereferencing it, not dereferencing foo and accessing 0. Which is more important when it's not 0, but something like 10, in which case you'll be accessing very different things. And this in particular comes up on next week's homework. Not bomb homework, but the next one. It's a common point of confusion. As is always true when we're talking about precedence, when in doubt, add parentheses. If you don't know what it does, just put more parentheses in there or use temporary variables. We're not going to deduct points for doing that. Like, you should never be uncertain about are we doing the array access first or not. And another confusing thing is that star foo plus plus increments the pointer and dereferences the result of the post increment, so it dereferences what the pointer used to point to before the increment. It does not increment the thing pointed to.
So do address of and dereference have like the lowest precedence compared to the other?
Do they have the lowest precedent? I am not in the right space to remember exactly how it works and lower precedences mean precisely, so sorry, can't answer that. I just know enough precedents to know when I need to add parentheses. And probably add parentheses a few more times than I'm supposed to. So any other questions about this? Okay, so since we all know about pointers, here's exercise. So figure out what the value of our string foo is. So one notable thing that I will talk about briefly is I told you earlier that, hey, we have a constant string, it's in read-only memory, we're not supposed to change it. So here I'm doing something slightly different. I'm declaring an array that's going to be stored presumably on the stack, and I'm initializing it to a string. But unlike what I showed you earlier, unlike doing char star foo equals foo, this would point to read-only memory. So if I did a char star, that's going to point to read-only memory. Since I'm declaring an array, it's going to copy it into that new array. It's going to allocate an array on the stack with four elements and copy the string into there. If I just have a character pointer and assign the string to it, it's going to give me a pointer to the original version of the string in read-only memory. So that means that if this crashes, it's not going to be because we're writing read-only memory. So go through this, figure out what you think foo turns into.
syntax makes a copy.
Yeah. For initialization.
Yeah.
Only. The original foo is in read-only memory. What we have in, written on the slide copies from that read-only memory to the stack. But if you have charstar, it doesn't. You just do charstar foo equals foo. It doesn't copy. It just points to the original. So the line on the slide declares it not in, declares it on the stack. Copied from read-only memory when you make the array.
I string literal itself. Should there be a line before
that? No. No, this is done because it's a string constant. It has to be somewhere. Typically, it varies. Okay. So who needs more time? Okay, so who thinks the answer is A, B, C, D, E? Okay, so most people agreed on the same answer, and hopefully that's right. At least my slide thinks it is. So let's talk about what's going on here. So we have foo, which as I mentioned is on the stack. So this, because we're declaring an array, the array is going to exist on the stack. If we just declared a pointer, that means we aren't putting anything on the stack except the pointer. So we have an array on the stack that's initially set to contain the string foo, which is FOONA / 0, the 0 byte. So the first thing we do is we make our pointer point to foo, and since we're using an array, in a case where you want a pointer, that's going to give us a pointer to the first element of the array. So we have a pointer to the F, and now we dereference that pointer and ask to set it to the character B, so we change our F to a B. Then we modify the pointer itself by adding 2, and since it points to a char, we advance 2 chars in memory. So we advance to the O, the last O in foo. Then we do pointer at 0 equals z. So this is the same thing as star pointer equals z, because it's the same as star pointer plus 0 equals z. Because of that equivalence between the array indexing syntax and the star and plus. So it's exactly the same. Probably, I would always write star pointer in real code because I think it's confusing to use array indexing on things which are kind of in the middle of an array. But you can do whatever you like. And then we have star foo plus 1 equals A. You would normally write foo at 1 equals A, which is exactly the same. And so that's setting the what was the previously a remaining O to an A, and we get pass. So any questions on any part of this example? Yes?
Just a question about C. If you want to set a string all at once, what's the syntax for doing that?
What do you mean set a string all at once?
Like if you just want to say foo equals pass.
The easiest way of doing that is to call a standard library function.
Okay.